Broadcasting live from the Annex Wealth Management Studios at The Avenue, it's time for Point Taken. Here are your hosts, Steve Scafidi and Kristen Bride.
Happy Tuesday. Steve is still on vacation. He'll be out for the whole week. He'll be back on Monday. But joining me for the full hour today, it has been a minute. She has been very busy teaching the youths over at Marquette University. But Judge Mary Kunmench is back in seat for the full hour.
Thanks for having me on, Kristen. It's been a Milwaukee minute, but I was using that time productively, shaping and hopefully causing young people to think about things in a different way. As I am a teacher over at an instructor, an adjunct professor at Marquette University, and I'm having a ball.
What were you teaching? What was the class?
I was teaching a class called Empathy.
Oh!
Empathy, Crime, and Justice. So I had a class of about 26 upperclassmen, juniors and seniors, mostly seniors, at Marquette in the pre-law and the criminal justice program, talking about the role, if any, of empathy in the criminal justice system. And I had a remarkable experience because I had 26 really engaged young people who taught me a thing or two. And it was like teaching my grandchildren, and it was a great exchange and a great opportunity that I couldn't turn down. And they've asked me to come back and do it again in the fall.
All right, well, we're going to get into these topics, but now I'm fascinated by this topic. So did you create the curriculum? Did you pick out all the readings and everything?
Yes, I did.
It's so fascinating. So what are some of the things that you have them read as far as what role empathy plays in our criminal justice system?
Well, I had them read, believe it or not, Jesus's Sermon on the Mount.
Okay.
That's the otherwise known as the Gospel of Matthew, I think, verses 3 through 9, the Beatitudes. I had them where Jesus taught, he's the original preacher of empathy and care, you know, walk in another one's shoes. Yeah. I had them read, reread that everybody, I think, has read either in high school or college, To Kill a Mockingbird, and the empathy of someone like Atticus Finch. And I said, be an Atticus Finch. And in what ways was he empathetic, and how did that play into his defense of Tom, who was accused of a crime that he did not commit? And then I also had them read Night by Elie Wiesel and his experience in Auschwitz, and how people crack and lose all sense of empathy when they're put in extreme positions. And how do we judge the lack of empathy among even the people in the camps who started turning on each other just for survival? So, you know, we looked at it from a lot of different angles and a lot of different generational perspectives and different extreme situations. But I walked them. I think we even had a reading. I had them read the Gettysburg Address by Abraham Lincoln and his second inaugural address with Justice for All and Malice Towards None. How empathetic he was in trying to get the reintegration of the Confederate states back into the Union. So it was an interesting class for me to design and then ultimately teach and then have students react to it. And just a very, very good experience. And I'll be teaching it again. And I'm looking at tweaking it a little bit, but not much, because the feedback I got from my students was that they looked at empathy in a completely different way. And in terms of how they're going to now approach that and use that in their own interactions. I talked about, for their generation, how empathetic is that you put your parents on a schedule as to when you're going to call them. And you don't even call them. You have Friday at 9 a.m. when you have a free hour is when you text them. And they're I said, you know how.
Is this what your kids do to you?
Of course. But I mean, even my grandchildren, and I've told them that their Christmas gift to me this year is to actually call me and surprise me as opposed to texting me, hey, Grandma, anybody using the Packer tickets? So I tried to talk to them in language that they can understand. And I also told them that they should be the empathetic generation, because they're the ones where my generation was tucking and ducking under desks because of nuclear war and the Cuban Missile Crisis of the 60s. Their generation has lived through some, you know, incredibly harmful to their mental health and to their physical health, obviously, but school shootings and having to learn how to protect yourself when there is a, you know, an armed person has entered the building, and they, so they've grown up with school shootings ever since Columbine, all the way through the university shootings and some of the other, you know, more violent, circumstances that they've had to endure, including COVID and having to learn remotely. So I try to cut them a little slack because Gen Zers have had it tough. They had COVID. They've had school shootings. They are learning in a completely different environment. I don't give them a free pass in terms of how, they're empathetic, but I talk to them in those terms so that they understand that, you know, empathy is a two-way street. You've experienced some of these things, so you know when you're interacting with somebody who may need, 15 minutes of your time to just listen to them or to call them and call your grandparents, call your parents, just to, you know, to engage in a, you know, in a actual conversation and sort of hiding behind, you know, social media and our cell phones with texting. I think it's done incredible damage to people's mental health and to how we communicate with each other. And I think it's at the root, not of all evil, but it's certainly at the root of a lot of the divisiveness in this country. People can say ungodly things to each other and they're anonymous. I'm a public figure. I've lived with it my entire life, having been in the public realm. And you know that that's part of the business. I happen to be friends with somebody who's in a fairly well-known actress in Hollywood, and she just lives in Nashville. But we just texted about this yesterday, about how she tries to put herself out there for her fans with respect to social media. But in the minute she takes a position, whether it's a conservative position or a more liberal position, it's a no-win. People just jump all over her, and so her natural inclination is to retreat. And I told her to keep up the good fight, and that she still needs to be engaged. And she said, I probably do, but I'm second guessing myself every time I interact with people and I get a response.
I got to cut you off right there. It was fascinating. I also wanted to hear, maybe on a different time, the argument for no empathy, if there is one, and if you teach it at all. But we'll move on from there. When we come back, retired judge, adjunct professor Mary Kuhn-Mensch is here for the full hour, and we're going to talk a little bit about those California election results and how they're still counting them and what that means for us as far as the messaging for this fall. So stay with us on Point Taken. Well, welcome back to Point Taken. I am Kristen Bry. Steve is out for the week. We are talking to retired judge Mary Kuhn-Mensch, back from, it's been a minute since you've been here, largely requested.
Probably, I think, March,
since
right around
March?
My birthday. Yeah, because I gave a shout out to one of my grandsons for their birthday. So, in fairness, Steve had asked me, and I said, you know, I've committed to Marquette, and I'm busy with that Monday, Wednesday, and Friday, and also prepping, and there's meetings involved in it, and developing curriculum for a class that you're now going to teach on a regular basis at Marquette. What I really loved about the experience is I love the Jesuit philosophy of care for the whole, you know, the intellectual part of a student, but their mental, their emotional, their spiritual, and their physical side. And their new president, well, he's not so new. He's been there over, he was the provost. Kimo Ayun has been, he's a friend of mine, and he's been the president there for, I think, going on 2 years. But he's done a wonderful job of really continuing Lovell's philosophy of making it a student-centric organization. And all the faculty that I have been dealing with are so on board with that and so conscious of their responsibilities to the students, you know, because they're paying a pretty good nickel to go there.
Yeah.
So we are of one mind on that everything we're doing is for the benefit of the students.
Absolutely. All right. Well, not that this affects us directly, but it probably will affect us in one way, because it is a bigger conversation around voting fraud. So California had their election, their primary election, a week ago, and the results are starting to finally come to a close, but it's been almost a week after Election Day, and they were still counting votes. And so now we know President Trump has taken that opportunity to make claims that this is evidence of fraud. He stormed out of the NBC interview over the weekend with Kristen Welker because she was pushing back on that. And we're now potentially seeing the same argument that could be made this fall in places where the election does not go Republicans' way. And if this comes back as far as this is clearly fraud is happening. Because we had yesterday, Mike Johnson was asked about this. And this is what he had to say.
I'm not saying it's rigged. I'm saying it stinks to high heaven, and everybody knows that. Let's remove the appearance of impropriety. Let's have what a concept. Let's have votes on an election the day of the election. That's what many states are able to do. I think California is playing around with this.
But what evidence is there to prove that there was this rigged?
Look, I don't. Some of these efforts are so diabolical and so far upstream it is impossible to prove. But I think everybody knows instinctively something is wrong here. And that's a concern. We need people to believe in the integrity of our election system.
Impossible to prove. When you make that argument, how is there ever going to be anything settled as far as trusting elections if you have some of the top, like the, one of the top leaders in the Republican Party saying, well, we know that it's happening. We just can't prove it because it's impossible. And how is anyone ever going to trust elections?
That's, you know, there's a lot to unpack here. And I want to put my teacher hat on and talk really about what I think is going on in terms of election law. I have somewhat of a, I think, credibility and background in it because I've worked as an election supervisor. I did it during 2020 when COVID was going on. They were desperate to have supervisors and a couple of us judges decided. I had just recently retired, and much to my family's dismay, I agreed and I served as a election supervisor in a huge chunk of Milwaukee County. And we took enough precautions to protect me, I thought. And so I think I have some credibility because I've actually worked in the system. What I would say about Mike Johnson's comments, though, is that's the problem, whether that's coming from him as the speaker or if it would come from, you know, a leader of the Democratic Party. That is one of the most harmful things that we can state, because he's stating it as a fact, and it's not a fact. So, you know, we're getting to the point where leaders are trying to persuade all Americans that instinctively we all know this. Well, I consider myself a fairly intelligent person, and I don't instinctively think that. Talk about the dumbing down of America, to paraphrase Charlie Sykes. The reality is that that is a very harmful and untruthful thing to say. You are stating something as a fact to and say, yeah, that's true. So as to cause doubt in every institution, including our elections, so as to curry favor with conspiracy theorists and the sort of the lowest base among us, instead of raising the bar and trying to raise the elevation or to discuss it in reasonable and rational terms as to this is what's really going on. And this is why people like Governor Newsom are even, you know, I can see Mike Johnson saying this. Newsom has even said this is going to create the length of how long it's taking to do this is taking, is causing people that are already predisposed to believe in conspiracy theories and to question every fact or every institution we have. We're turning into a nation of doubters so that anybody who comes up with their own set of facts, that's credible. Why is that more credible than mine? Because facts are empirical. They can be proven through science, through intelligence, through reading, through using our brains and rationalizing. It's what we instruct juries to do. Use not only your common sense, but use each other and the backgrounds that you each bring with how you view things and come to a verdict in this case. So to sort of break down what he's saying, separate and apart from the real issues that are going on in this election, I wanted to say cast that aside completely, Kristen. Have your audience cast that aside. Resist the temptation to jump on a bandwagon that says, of course there's something going on. Of course it's wrong. Of course there's, you know, only a dummy wouldn't believe that. Well, no, that's simply not true. And we've got to have more people that simply go back to Mike Johnson, to a Democrat or Republican who espouses that kind of nonsense, and say, no, that's simply not true. Let's put our intelligence to work. Let's problem solve, work the problem, as they did in Apollo 13, people. Let's work the problem and figure out how we fix this. And I've got some ideas about that that I'll share in just a moment.
Absolutely. All right. So when we come back, we'll talk about some solutions to this with retired Judge Mary Kuhnmensch. And I'm Kristen Bry, and this is Point Taken. Welcome back to Point Taken. I am Kristen Bry here with Mary Kuhnmensch, fan favorite. All right, so we have about 2 minutes, so we can't get too much into the case because I want to hear more about your ideas for solutions. But let's just lay the framework for the groundwork for how California does their elections, because I was unaware that they now you have to vote by mail, because when I lived there, you could still vote in person. So that must be a switch in the last 10 years?
California is, I don't know when they adopted it, but they're one of eight states that does it that way. They
okay.
And so if we're going to have problems calling, and both, and interestingly enough, they're both red and blue states, and they're mostly Rocky Mountain or Western states. I suspect, I don't know, but I suspect there's reasons for that because of the availability of voting staff to man on Election Day. Do they have enough personnel? Do they have enough funds to run in-person elections? Is it more costly? So I suspect there's some financial reasons and some logistical reasons, because those are states that have, for instance, Montana and Wyoming. Nobody would ever say that those are blue states. Those are red states, and they conduct it. Wyoming in particular is one of the eight states that conducts it by mail. And so there are delays that are absolutely built into the process. So if you're, it's not a question of fraud, because they've even had newsmen, including Billy Bush, get involved and actually go through this election process with elections officials in California. And they have all concluded, both conservative and liberal ones, that it's not the people in the voting that are counting the ballots. It's the system itself. And
all
we'll
right.
talk about that after the
after,
break.
After the break. Good timing. You really watched the clock, Mary. Welcome back to Point Taken. I'm Kristen Bry. Steve is out for the week, but we are talking to retired Judge Mary Kuhnmensch all hour. We have another half hour with her today. And we've been talking about the California election results, which I think are top of mind as well. And the thing is, like, would it be top of mind had Spencer Pratt also come in second, right? Would this have been all of a sudden an opportune time for President Trump and Speaker Mike Johnson to talk about voter fraud again, had it not gone where there was a huge surge for Spencer Pratt, who ran as an independent but is a registered Republican. And then as more ballots got counted, the progressive candidate who was in third place has now surged up against him. And I think it's official now. I think he's lost.
Yes.
And so obviously, I understand, right? When there are certain states where like all the votes are counted and we have a tally the night of, and then there's certain states where we don't. We obviously in Wisconsin always know that the quote unquote Milwaukee dump. And so when you look at this, where do you see actual problems that is problems being very different than fraud?
We're trying to serve gourmet food in a country that wants fast food, meaning we want everything fast because that's how we've been trained. You know, and the fast food is great. It's not too nutritious, but it's great because of the speed at which you can fill your stomach when you're hungry. And I say that not jokingly. I mean it. I think what's happened is because of the speed of sound, because of the speed of with which we get our news, with which we hunger for news and answers, we want answers right away. And sometimes you've got to work the problem, and that problem solving takes time. In elections, it just feeds, even Newsom will concede this, it feeds fear, confusion in the minds of the general public, even reasonable, rational people who, they still say, well, why is it taking so long? And doesn't time mean that it's time for people to kind of play hanky-panky with stuff and to insert themselves in the election somehow? So that's the problem with mail-by voting in the eight states that primarily do it that way, California being one of them, but also, as I said, some red states, including places like Wyoming and Utah. Here's the deal. California has set up a whole processing process that is based on verify, verify, verify. They have like three default-type processes that three different parts of the election workers have to involve themselves in. Opening them, making sure that nothing's been tampered with the envelopes, making sure that the seal on the affidavit part of the ballot hasn't been broken, because they find that to be the most critical. Making sure that the signatures match what they have on file. That verification process builds in hundreds of hours of election workers' time.
And that's people. That's not a machine.
That is people. That's manual labor done tediously by human beings. And we're so used to having the answer, you know, NBC declares, you know, President Trump the winner of this presidential election, you know, at 10:30 at night or 8:30 right after the last states have voted. So, you know, we want that. We're trained to want it. And that's not unreasonable. Unfortunately, when you go to a process like all ballots are sent out by mail and you expect people to either bring it back in directly to the clerk's office in the county in which they live, or they mail it back in. So that increases the time frame by which you start the election process and the time for which you then
end it.
And that's causing litigation all the way up to the Supreme Court with a decision that's going to come out this month in June. Our Supreme Court is looking at that very issue of should states count ballots that come in after the election day, the actual election day of November 2nd or November 3rd.
Because as of right now, as long as it's postmarked by election day, it counts.
Correct.
So if you mail it on election day,
yes,
in certain states, and that's what happens in California, right? I think it was something
and
like,
the reason we've
like
done
25%
is-
of the votes were mailed on election day, so postmarked correctly, but didn't come in until after election day, which is why they're still counting.
And so it's a kind of an outdated system because think about how many people really rely, and quite unfortunately, it's more low-income people that still rely on the Postal Service for all their mailing issues. And the government still relies on it. That's how our military, they get it through military mail, but it's still the mail system. And so if you know, as I've explained to our listeners in the past, you know, old contract law that is still in place and is still considered good is your acceptance, which we're, you know, if you're doing business back in the 1800s with a company, you're in California and doing it with a company that's in New York, the way they did it was by mail. It was pre-telephones, you know, after the Pony Express, but pre-telephones. And so you are relying on the mail to do contractual matters. And so the way that the contract law evolved is that the minute you postmark your acceptance of the offer that's been sent to you by the person in California, now I'm in New York and I'm accepting it, it's the day I put the stamp on it and stick it in the mailbox. And that's our contract law, which is still good law to this day. We've applied that because, again, it's using the mail service to elections as well. And so we're relying on our mail service, even though many, many people, when they really need a package and they need it fast and they need it on time, they're going to spend the extra $10, $20, $30, $40 to use UPS. They're going to use Federal Express. They're going to use any other number of the private mail couriers or services like Amazon. And everybody that buys things online knows what I'm talking about. I need it tomorrow. You'll pay the extra money to do that. We are expecting the mail service to be at that same level. And the reality is, folks, anybody who uses the mail service knows that there's always a chance that it could, A, get lost, B, that it doesn't come in on time. And so there's good reasons for why we have said it's postmarked. So look at the postmark when it comes in. And that's what states decided when they developed their voting rights by mail. Let's look at what the postmark says, not when it actually comes in. Then now it's going to be interesting to see how the Supreme Court, because they know as a reality, that is the issue, the thorny issue that's, you know, these things come in from our military late. Are we not going to count their ballots? Are we not going to count the ballots of people that are infirmed and can't get to a voting booth on the day, on election day? There are legitimate reasons. Even Donald Trump acknowledges that he uses and has used for the last several elections vote by mail. He gave the reason that it was because he's president, but he didn't have to do that. He could say, because there's legitimate reasons for me to do it. And it's I rely on it because I believe in it. And that would have ended a lot of this sort of conspiracy stuff. But the reality is people are trying to use it as, let's have a conspiracy theory. Voting by mail takes more time. It takes, you want to build in verifications that people can rely on and trust. And Billy Bush, if anybody remembers him, he's the one who had the conversation with
the Access president. Hollywood conversation.
Yeah, Hollywood conversation. Everybody remembers that from the 2016 or 2020 election. And as a result, you should understand that Billy Bush really would find something like this very interesting. So he took his podcast live past week.
That's a good tease. We'll stop there. We'll come back. We'll talk a little bit more about what Billy Bush did and what he has to do with voting in California. She's Mary Kuhn-Mensch. I'm Kristen Bride. This is Point Taken. Welcome back to Point Taken. I'm Kristen Bride talking to Mary Kuhn-Mensch. And you actually said an interesting thing at the break just now. You think in order to save democracy, is that what you said? The save democracy, help democracy?
Yes.
You think that we should limit mail-in voting?
Yes, I do.
So talk a little bit more about that.
I think the greatest generation, I think baby boomers, people my age, we are have been trained and we have accepted for, you know, my time on this planet that you when you vote, it is the highest part of your of the actions you can take as a citizen of the United States of America. And if we love our country and we believe in democracy, then get up off the couch and find a way, either on a bus or a neighbor or whoever, Uber, and get to your voting booth and vote in person. Now, having said that, because that's an act of citizenry, that's the highest act of citizenry, writing letters to the editor, writing your congressmen and your senators when you think they're doing something boneheaded, that's what a democracy requires. You have to exert some effort to get off the couch, get out of your house, don't be isolated, interact with other people, and go vote. Now, having said that, we are also have a constitution that says that all citizens have the right, citizens, even birthright citizens, and I think on that decision coming out in June as well, this Supreme Court is going to uphold that there is birthright citizenship. Thank goodness for that. I'd be very shocked if they went the other way, given some of the questions that even people like Justice Roberts and Justice Coney Barrett asked the Republican advocates.
Won't be unanimous, though.
It won't be unanimous, but it will be a 5-4 or a 6-3 decision is my bet. Having said that, there are legitimate reasons why we have vote by mail. We are a country that is vast, that have people serving overseas in support of our actions, whether they're in diplomatic offices or serving in the military. They still, even though it's military mail, they still rely on a mail service. We have people who are infirmed, who are citizens of this country and have a right for an accommodation to be made. And that means that people in nursing homes or people who are infirmed in home, by proof of a doctor's letter or the head of the nursing home can give a list of all the citizens that live in that particular nursing home, that's the amount of ballots that should be dropped off by the Election Commission. They should be allowed to vote by mail because they can't obviously vote in person. And there are people who know ahead of time that their company's going to send them, you know, on a overseas duty. They're now going to be stationed in the international wing of Briggs & Stratton or A.O. Smith, and they're not going to be in the country.
Or they're students. Knowing ahead of time you're not going to be here for
correct.
Election day.
And so there are legitimate parts of our population that we should have a vote-by-mail process. It should be secure. It should be uniform across the country. And that means that the federal government needs to do a couple of things. My solution is I am not a big believer it has created the problem that they're dealing with, and even Newsom has said that. We're creating confusion. We're creating delays because of the process we have set up, only vote by mail, and that takes man hours because we're not using...
It's also the most populous state, right?
Yeah,
so there's a lot of votes.
A lot of votes. What did you tell me? I thought it was, you know...
Well, there's 40, like there's almost 40 million people in the state. I don't know how many people are voting because they don't have like Wisconsin voter turnout rates because, you know, California is a red state. I mean, a blue state. So I think a lot of people, there's voter suppression, a lot of people thinking that their vote doesn't matter. But we got to take one more break. So we'll finish up the conversation with Mary Kuhn Mensch about this after this commercial. It always goes so fast when Mary Kuhn Mensch is here. She has so much to say and so much wisdom to share. But closing on this topic for today, Mary, what are your final thoughts when it comes to what's happening in California and what this means for us for the rest of this year and midterms?
Well, I think number one, just to follow up on my thought about Billy Bush, he actually went in there with his podcast team and they allowed him in. I think he went in 2 days ago now. And I happened to just catch, don't ask me why, but I happened to catch his podcast. And I tried to get a variety of voices. And so he was one of them. And he was highly, he praised, and it's still online if anybody wants to check it out. Billy Bush hot mics, and he actually went in, and all the workers there, the government workers, the volunteers, he had nothing but praise for them. He said it's virtually impossible for any of them to try and interfere because they're all on top of each other. They're all on camera. He was able to get within 20 feet of them and watch exactly what they're doing, and he was amazed at at the dedication and the focus and commitment to getting these done. But the problem is it's man hours. I think you looked it up, 18 million people voted.
Over, yeah, around 8.
Think about the time it takes to open and process those ballots, given the verification processes that states that only vote by mail have in place. And because they wanted to satisfy Republicans and other people who thought that there was a chance for fraud, they tried to alleviate it. So they pile on verification process after verification process. They have three double checks. That process adds, doing that adds time into the process. And then tabulating them, which is counting them, is another part of it. And that they do by machine, so by computer. But it doesn't concern me that it's taking this long with 18 million votes having to be processed that all came in through mail? Not at all. And Billy Bush concluded that. He said the problem is the system that we have put in place here in California, not the workers or the people who are actually fulfilling their duty by getting these things verified and counted. And he had all the trust in the world for them. So what I would say is it's an argument for why we do need to have a vote by mail process. I think we need to come up with some reasonable rules as to who gets to and how they establish that they need to vote by mail, how that process, what the time frame will be that we mail the ballots out. It should be uniform and consistent across the country. For mail ballots, every state should do it the same way. When you want to do it locally for in-person voting, every state has the right to set it up by their own election, their election commissions that every state, including ours, has. But with uniform and consistency across the country in terms of the rules of who gets to vote by mail, how that process is done, we take the confusion and the worry out of this. And it's a necessary part of our election system.
All right. As always, we love having you here. Thank you for your wisdom. Retired Judge Mary Kuhn-Mensch, adjunct professor at Marquette University. We'll be back with more after the top of the hour news.
Broadcasting live from the Annex Wealth Management Studios at The Avenue, it's time for Point Taken. Here are your hosts, Steve Scafidi and Kristen Bryan.
Welcome back to Hour 2 of Point Taken. Steve is out until Monday. We still got a full show for you today, though. So, I think it was 2 weeks ago when we had Republican candidate for governor Tom Tiffany on the show. And one of the things about the show is it goes fast. As anyone who was just listening with Judge Mary Kuhn-Mensch, this show goes very fast. Our segments go fast. And when you have a candidate on, sometimes you have so much you want to get to that you can't dive in on one topic for too long. And one of those topics for me in re-listening to our conversation with Tom Tiffany was, you know, he's dabbling in having questions about our election 2020, right? It's kind of as we were just talking with Mary Kuhn-Mensch, as far as there is this rumblings of trying to revisit about what our election securities are. And in that conversation with him 2 weeks ago, he referenced, when we pushed him a little bit harder on what are you talking about as far as like when you think about what was wrong with the 2020 election, and he specifically mentioned Green Bay.
Second thing is the Zuckerbucks that came in, $15 million. And the Green Bay mayor hired a political operative from New York City to come and help them in Green Bay. They ultimately forced the city clerk and elected official out. It should only be elected officials that take care of these elections. That political operative, not elected, ended up with three of the four keys to the central count. Now, that doesn't mean that the election was not.
Well, that's my question.
Yeah, so that doesn't mean fraud.
It doesn't mean that. But you have these improprieties and people continue to ask questions.
Oh, there's that word again. Impropriety. All right. So after that election, I heard from State Representative Ahmaud Rivera-Wagner, who at the time was working for Mayor Genrich, and had some thoughts as far as how Tom Tiffany presented what happened in Green Bay. So Ahmaud joins us now. Welcome to the show.
Thank you for having me.
So remind us. So you were the chief of staff for Mayor Eric Genrich.
Yeah.
In 2020.
That's right.
So what was your position as far as when, like, how were you involved in the election that year?
So if people remember, in 2020, in the April election of that year, Green Bay only had two open polling sites because we lost over 50% of our poll workers. In that case, nearly 100% of our poll workers.
Am I going to get close? Yeah.
Perfect. Nearly 100% of our poll workers due to COVID and the lack of COVID protections. We even sued the
similar
state.
In Milwaukee, right? Milwaukee had a bunch of polling stations closed.
So in the aftermath of that, we worked with how do we make sure that the fall election is safe and protected? How do we ensure that people get PPE? We got bipartisan support to get some grants into those elements. And I was serving as the mayor's chief of staff. My actual job that day was just to make sure that the volunteers and city staff came up for their shifts, had pizza and water, and really just, you know, made sure that we count. We knew it was going to be a long count, and there was over 24 hours of counting. And so that was really my actual job. What ended up happening the day of, despite all of this...
This is the day of the November election, right, not the primary.
Right, not the primary. November election, we the city was just fine, but we actually had all these outside agitators that came in that claimed that there were China ballots and tried to break into City Hall. They, when ballots were being dropped off at our central count, people were calling the police traitors. They thought that I didn't work for the city because I was a person of color. So they thought I was an immigrant that worked for Facebook that was running central count.
So is that who he's referencing in the that's quote? He was talking about you being a Facebook employee?
That's one of the people. And then we had worked with Safer at Home, a larger conglomerate of Democrats and Republicans, and they brought in some advisors just like, hey, these are some ways to like create stronger logistic flows. His name was Michael. And so, which was helping the entire state of Wisconsin, and red and blue areas had these folks in there. That is the alleged political operative that we hired. We didn't actually hire anybody. It was just an advisor that was part of a grant process that was accepted by our common council. There were no keys to central count. It was a supply closet, and no one actually had access to them. We actually live streamed our central count. Everyone was invited there. In fact, on the day of, Republican operatives said, this is probably one of the most transparent processes we've ever seen. Only later to be met with that when Trump lost, that somehow it was Milwaukee and Green Bay's fault because it took us so long to get the election. So I learned later that I was a Democratic operative who made up having a husband that was an undocumented immigrant, being a Facebook employee. I found that out on January 6th when we actually had a protest outside where a current council member asked for the Proud Boys, a white supremacy group, to come and enact violence against me, the mayor, and our first black clerk. And so these conspiracy theories have real consequences. It would be hilarious if it wasn't so dangerous. So in Green Bay, Wisconsin, the number one place to live in the United States.
Is it still the rating?
It's not still. But you know, once you're number one, you're forever number one. One of the safest places in the country, just even recently ranked. We had to get an alarm system. I had to work with the FBI and a protection plan. They thought I made up being married to my husband. So they stalked all the medical professionals at our hospitals, which required us to do safety plans for emergency rooms, all because conspiracy theorists kept concocting reasons why they lost the election. Not because they didn't do all the machinations of campaigning, but because they needed to make up a reason to undermine the election. And so I happened to be one of those victims. And it caused real issues. We had folks attacking our police. We have the average age of our poll worker is over 60. So these are people's meemaws and pop-ups, and they were being stalked and asked to be arrested. We had people attempting to break into City Hall, trying to run police officers off the road to stop them from delivering ballots. And so when I hear someone running for office to be the highest executive in our land, casually playing with the idea that there were keys that don't exist, that there were operatives that never happened, allowing for the worst actors in this state that we've ever seen, that those we're just asking questions, makes them to me completely wholly unqualified to hold office at the state level. If you cannot tell the difference between fact and fiction, if you cannot understand that this is dangerous times where something, where a lie goes a mile before the truth gets out the door, I don't think you should be governing an entire state, let alone being at any elected level. And we saw that had real consequences in our local elections. We don't elect election deniers now in Green Bay, Wisconsin.
What do you mean by that?
Meaning that for a long time, there were people who were saying, we're just asking questions. Nearly all of them.
And that we're getting elected for like local office?
We're getting elected for local office. Nearly every single one of them lost in the recent years in Green Bay, Wisconsin. Nearly every single one that was perpetuating these lies not only didn't get reelected, and if they did, they no longer believe those lies anymore. And so I think it says something that's not a winning strategy. It's not an electoral winning strategy. Michael Gableman, that spent $2.3 million investigating our city, trying to arrest the mayors, the mayor I worked for, the mayor of Madison, no longer can practice law for the next 3 years. right? This is not a winning strategy to turn our neighbors and our friends into our enemies for the sake of political points. It just isn't something that's great.
All right, let's take a break quickly. We are talking to State Representative Ahmad Rivera Wagner, who was also the chief of staff of Mayor Eric Genrich of Green Bay during the 2020 election. We'll talk a little bit more about election security, where we're going from here, and we'll probably have some texts on the text line because, you know, it's always a spicy topic. So stay with us on Point Top. Point taken. Welcome back to Point Taken. I am Kristen Bry. Steve is off until next week. We are talking to State Representative Ahmad Rivera Wagner because he had, is it fair to say a visceral reaction to when Tom Tiffany was on our show 2 weeks ago and when we pressed Congressman Tiffany on the 2020 election and his thoughts. He kind of threw out Green Bay as one of the improprieties. Is that the word that he used? Yeah. As far as the irregularities that happened during the 2020 election. And since you were heavily involved in the election in Green Bay in 2020, you had a lot of thoughts. And so I guess as we, in the previous segment, we kind of debunked what the ongoing accusations were. But as far as someone who has lived through threats and everything that you had to deal with in 2020, you still live in Green Bay. Like, did you ever have the opportunity, not on a comment section, but like to sit down with people who were concerned, were election deniers, and like actually have real conversations with them? And like, were you ever able to change anyone's mind? And I guess the follow up question to that is like, how do we put the genie back in the bottle?
Well, one, I wanted to say, like, we're seeing even now the president of the United States calling into question elections that don't go the way he wants. So right now we're seeing in California where the Republican candidate for L.A. mayor didn't make it to the runoff, even though that was highly anticipated. And now we're already starting to see the rise of election denialism using the kind of spitting machine of the extreme right. So one, it's still here, right? I don't know if it will always be here.
Oh, yeah, go on Twitter. Trump, like, it's still totally
right
here.
But what I will say, one of the things that we saw in Green Bay, and we worked with a lot of experts around the country, most people are inclined to believe that the system that is set up is a successful one, that fraud is actually incredibly rare, if it happens at all, that we have great mechanisms for doing that. And so what we did in Green Bay is said, this is an opportunity for us to be more open and more clear about what does our process look like? How do we do our checks and balances? And what the research would tell you is that generally when you do a better job of explaining the process, really putting things out there, having as many extra kind of conversations that you can, the vast majority of people will be like, you know what, that makes sense. I might have had a question. Maybe there was a ring of truth to something that they were worried about. And this really dispels it and allows them to also defend the election. What we found is that vast majorities of people were like, thank you for educating us. This is really helpful. Or, you know, I did have questions, but I've been a poll worker. I don't have them. That was by far the vast majority of people. We still had the extremist far right, including as recently as your show, repeating debunked conspiracy theories because it thinks it scores them political points with MAGA extremists. That is where it's at now. It's not that they actually believe them. I've had meetings with Christian conservatives, MAGA leaders, and they tell me privately, obviously this is crazy. These things clearly never happened. We all know that. But then when it comes to like doing that publicly, we see them hide behind the fact that some of the members of their base will find it disqualifying unless you call Green Bay's elections fraudulent or that there were improprieties, right? We had to work really hard to go from we stole the election to into proprieties, but that is a good sign that the information and putting more information out does make a huge difference. But I also think there needs to be accountability. One of the things that helped us the most was when Michael Gableman spent $2.3 million and got bipartisan condemnation for his investigation. We did have folks from all different walks of life saying, this has gone too far. And so holding people accountable for the lies and the danger of their lies, we know makes a huge difference. And that's why, as a legislator, I've been really pushing to ensure that if you are interfering with our elections using conspiracy theories and attacking poll workers and attacking individuals, that you should be held accountable like anyone else would be.
What is the current penalty if you threaten a poll worker or any of the intimidation tactics that we know that city clerks are feeling and could start feeling again come midterms? What is the actual protection that they have, and what is the accountability on the books right now?
So this is a fantastic question.
Okay.
Before 2020, basically nothing.
Basically nothing. So it was just like any kind of run-of-the-mill assault if you put your hands on someone.
And ironically, even that, there were judges that were reluctant because what they were invoking was their First Amendment rights. So, for example, in Green Bay, we had a MAGA activist at a random time during early vote accuse a woman's of being a mule because she was helping her quadriplegic husband absentee vote. And they thought that he shouldn't have the right to vote because he was quadriplegic. So they called her a mule to her face and tried to prevent her from actually casting a ballot with and for her husband, who was a quadriplegic. That went to court. Originally, she was fined. And then a judge later overruled it, saying that she had the First Amendment right to do that. So for a very long time, we didn't even have basic protections for poll workers because no one ever anticipated that you would stalk, harass, and violently attack a potential poll worker. That has basically never really happened in modern U.S. history, especially Wisconsin history. There has been some more laws that have passed on a bipartisan basis for poll worker protection, but the problem is those have increased. But when the conspiracy theories happen, sometimes they don't pick a poll worker. They might pick a random chief of staff. One of the people that got harassed was the postal worker. They thought the postal worker was in on the conspiracy theory. Those folks don't necessarily have the same protections, right? And so that is one of the things I've been working on in the legislature, is that we should make sure that anyone that's caught up in this type of conspiracy theories are protected, because it's so easy for it to become very, very dangerous, very, very fast.
Absolutely. All right. Well, thank you for reaching out. Yeah. Thank you for setting the record straight. State Representative Ahmaud Rivera-Wagner, thanks for making the drive down, too. You were here in person.
Yeah, no, anything for you. But also, you always make Green Bay look so wonderful. And I wanted to make sure we got the record and that we didn't really accept the kind of bullshit that Tom Tiffany is peddling. It just really, really is frustrating that in the 21st century, we need people who are running for office on the Democratic and Republican side who are actually trying to change real problems that we can have debates about, and not perpetuating lies that actually cost money and cost people's potential safety.
All right. Thank you so much for your time today. And we'll be back with more after this. All right. Thanks again to State Representative Ahmaud Rivera-Wagner for joining us. He and Governor Evers going down as two guys who we had to press the dump button for. But, you know, it's live radio for you. All right. When we come back, we're moving on from elections, finally. More time on Elections Day than expected, but that is okay. We're going to talk about high-speed rail. I know this is a divisive topic for a lot of people. I was not here during the Walker era when there was almost a train between Milwaukee and Madison, and now for some of us who would love to have that train here every time we have to go to Madison, lament that it is not. But having a conversation when we come back about what it would actually take to think big and put high-speed rail and make it take like 30 minutes to get from Milwaukee to Madison, or 30 minutes to get from Milwaukee to Lambeau, and you can stop taking that that shuttle bus to Lambeau and actually get there in style.
See that train, the midnight train, runs both ways. See that train, the midnight train, runs both ways.
Welcome back to Point Taken. I am Kristen Bry, and later this month, on June 25th, at the Oriental Theater, I am moderating another event, and it is called Thinking Big About Wisconsin Passenger Rail. And so if you listen to the show, it probably does not surprise you that I am a big fan of public transit. I lived in some big cities and was a big fan when I didn't have to have a car. Now I do have a car, but still love transit and love talking to people who also love transit and talk about what it would take to get more. So Rick Harnish is the executive director of the High Speed Rail Alliance, which he founded back in 1993. Rick, what was the conversation about high speed rail like in 1993?
Well, in 1993, Madrid to Seville opened, which is about the distance of Chicago to Detroit or Chicago to St. Louis, certainly farther than Chicago to Madison, and they opened that at 2 hours and 20 minutes, and they go through a mountain range. It's not like here where we've got real flat land. So we said if they can do it in Spain, we can do it in the United States, and that was our goal, to have a number of routes radiating out from Chicago.
There you go. And so what has, in 30 years, what has the progress looked like in the United States for high-speed rail? I feel like this is not a country that is known for embracing that.
Well, you know, for some reason, after World War One, we started really focusing on moving cars and not people. And despite the fact the majority of people wanted to take streetcars and were walking, we started redesigning our cities for cars. And we, the party really went out of bounds in the mid-50s with the interstate highway system. So we've got a long history of focusing on cars. Unfortunately, that's starting to turn. But we've made some progress. You know, the Amtrak service to Milwaukee is very good. We made significant progress on improving the Chicago to St. Louis and Chicago to Detroit corridors.
And so do we actually have, because there is a difference, right? So for people who are listening, when we talk about high-speed rail versus passenger rail, I mean, obviously high-speed rail is passenger rail, and that's the bigger umbrella. But what are the actual qualifications for something to be high-speed versus when we think of Amtrak now?
Well, what we really need between major cities is the train to be about half the time of driving and at least every hour, if not more frequently than that. So, you know, the drive time to Milwaukee is, depending upon where you're starting, well, let's go downtown to downtown, it's probably about 2 hours, right? 90 mm-hmm. minutes on a good day. So if you could get that down to an hour and have the train leave every half hour, you'd really have a game changer for both Chicago and Milwaukee and the places in between.
So do we have any high-speed rail routes in the states right now?
So the Acela corridor is the closest that we have.
Okay.
And, you know, what happened there was for various reasons, political forces were able to keep it from going away. And we've made small improvements to it over time. So that's the closest we've got. People love it. Amtrak provides way too few seats. A lot more people want to ride it. And so Amtrak charges higher rates than they should because so many people want to ride it.
Where, and remind me, where is the, what is the Acela Connect?
Washington, New York, Boston.
Oh, yeah. Okay, that makes sense. And so because, yeah. I mean, what everyone always talks about, right, as we always talk about, as I, someone who both lived in Los Angeles and San Francisco, is that they've never really been able to get this done connecting those two major metropolitans, metropolitan areas in California. And so what are some of the obstacles as doing this in 30 years, regardless of what state it is, of why this is hard to do?
Very simply, it's a simple answer that's more complicated, but the simple answer is because the legislature has never decided to do it. And so what really needs to happen is individuals across the state need to say, you know, if you're in Green Bay, I want to be able to take the train to Milwaukee. I want to take the train to Madison. I want to take the train to Chicago. I don't like the fact that you're forcing me to drive.
And is this a partisan, have you found this to be a partisan issue as you've, you know, lobbied for it in different states?
Not really. At the surface level, it is. But like many issues in this country, the two parties actually agree. They just talk about it differently. But, you know, Republican Governor Tommy Thompson was the one who created the very great plan to extend Amtrak service from Milwaukee, Chicago to Milwaukee to Madison. That was done under Tommy Thompson. He's got all that planning lined up.
And because I always think about this as, like, besides, like you said, with cars, because that's how I understand it. It was like as after World War One and the interstate was built and the emphasis on cars, because even Los Angeles, which is, a you know, not known for its public transit, at one point had better public transit and then the cars came along. And so is there just like a big motor vehicle lobby that also is lobbying against more passenger rail? Or is there people who are actively trying to sabotage this? Or is it just because it's hard to do hard things?
Well, you know, as a country, we made lots of decisions. And because we did it as a country, not as we can change that. We can push on our legislators to change it. Now, the auto companies, of course, they have a much bigger budget for marketing. They did make it illegal to what, you know, they created a new term called jaywalking. They made it illegal to be in the street, whereas before it was perfectly normal for people to be in the street. And then they lobbied really hard to get streets converted from walkable places to being focused on moving cars fast.
Yeah. All right, we're talking to Rick Harnish, the executive director of the High Speed Rail Alliance, which he founded back in 1993. When we come back, we're going to talk about the event that is happening in Milwaukee, Thinking Big About Wisconsin Passenger Rail, which is being put on by the High Speed Rail Alliance. So stay with us on Point Taken. Welcome back to Point Taken. I am Kristen Bry. We're talking to Rick Harnish, who is the executive director of the High Speed Rail Alliance, which is putting on an event on June 25th in Milwaukee called Thinking Big About Wisconsin Passenger Rail. And yours truly is going to be moderating the event. And I'm very excited about it. And so I guess my question is, Rick, why Wisconsin? And what is the potential when we think about passenger rail in Wisconsin?
So, you know, Wisconsin's a really cool state.
Thank you.
Got a lot of assets,
Because you guys are based in Chicago, so you're just south of us, for context.
I'm just south of you. You know, I've spent a fair amount of time in Milwaukee and Madison, and the bike trails in the state park. Anyway, Wisconsin's a great place to live, and it's a great place to do business. And you've got this string of cities from Chicago to Green Bay and actually up to the state line in two different directions, plus from Milwaukee over to Madison, and then up I-94 and I-90 towards Minnesota. They're all great places to be. And we can make them even better by making it possible to get between them without a car safely, productively, and affordably. And there's a thing right now called the Corridor ID, where the states can work with the federal government to create a long-term plan. And those routes are in the Corridor ID planning process, Milwaukee to Green Bay, Milwaukee to St. Paul, Madison, and Milwaukee to Chicago. And let's get people engaged in making those plans as big as they can be, because about every 5 to 10 years, there's some money that you can compete for in order to build the things. And the people who have the best plans get the money. So we're working to get business leaders to start working together to get the state legislature to fund the design work for these corridors.
So this is even, so there is no design even yet. So this is just setting things in motion to try to get our lawmakers to even fund what it could be.
So unfortunately, yes.
Okay.
The next step is actually doing design work. And that's, the people who have plans in place when resources are available are the ones who get the money.
Absolutely. Because that's the thing. And I don't know, how involved were you or aware were you? Because I was not living in Wisconsin at the time. But and people still talk about the train that wasn't under Governor Scott Walker, when there was money set aside, there was, I think, plans for a connection between Milwaukee and Madison, and ended up not happening. But that wasn't high-speed rail, right?
No, it was not high-speed rail. So with high-speed rail, you really do need to build completely new tracks so that you can go. Typically now the design speed is in Europe is 205 miles an hour. In China, they have a number of lines running at 220, and they've got one that they're doing the testing right now for 250, I think it is. What they were talking about doing was a really good program to extend the Hiawatha from Milwaukee to Madison. And again, that was designed by Republican Governor Tommy Thompson. And they put together a really good plan. It was under construction. And I believe that there was a coordinated effort by people who just don't want Americans to ride trains to kill off projects like that one by one. Because, the governor of New Jersey built a much-needed tunnel under the Hudson, which now is under construction again. Florida, Wisconsin, I think it was a very focused effort across the country to kill people's options.
Got it. All right. Well, who is this event for? As far as anyone who would want to come, who do you think? What would they get out of it? Pitch it for our listeners. As far as who should be there.
So, anybody who wishes they could take the train, or if they're taking the Hiawatha now, more options on when it is, when you can take the train and how fast it is. Or if you want to be able to take the train in Wisconsin and be engaged in helping make that happen, you should come to this event.
Absolutely. And it is called, it's going to be June 25th. It's called Thinking Big About Wisconsin Passenger Rail. It's going to be at the Oriental Theater. Like I said, I'm going to be there. We got a great lineup of panels and keynote speakers. And so if you text SPEED, S-P-E-E-D, to 855-616-1620, I will send you the link to the event. Rick Harnish, thank you so much for spending time with us today. And I can't wait to see you at the end of the month.
I'm looking forward to it. Thank you for your time.
Absolutely. Have a great day. Rick Harnish is the executive director of the High Speed Rail Alliance. We will take one more break and come back and wrap up today's show. All right. Another good show today. Thank you to Mary Kuhnmensch, as always. Always fun to have her here. Rick Harnish from High Speed Rail Alliance. And Ahmad Rivera Wagner for driving down from Green Bay to talk about, to rehash the 2020 election. We have a couple people texting SPEED to 855-616-1620 if you are interested in coming to the event on June 25th in person at the Oriental Theater. It's called Thinking Big About Wisconsin Passenger Rail. I am the moderator. The keynote speaker is going to be Hayden Clarkin, who's goes by the transit guy on social media. Mayor Cavalier Johnson's going to be there. Mayor Corey Mason from Essene's going to be there. Lafayette Crump. So it's going to be a good group of people for good conversations about what it could look like to try to advocate for this in the state of Wisconsin. And I just think about it, you know, we think about the fact that our state is not always great when it comes to drinking and driving. And I think some of that has to do with people who are maybe drinking and driving after a Packers game or after a Badgers game, and just thinking about the opportunities of being able to get on a train and get where you need to go a lot faster than driving. I think about that every single time I am on 94 and headed to Madison, of how much other stuff I could get done during that commute if I didn't have to be paying attention to that boring stretch of highway. So I'm a big fan. I think this is something that we should at least have discussions about. It's obviously not going to be voted on tomorrow, but I would love to see you there. Again, for more information on that event, text SPEED to 855-616-1620. That'll do it for us today. Tomorrow, Jake Curtis from Institute for Reforming Government is my guest co-host. He'll be here for all 2 hours. And if you know anything about Jake, I have a feeling that we are going to clash on a fair amount of topics, but it's going to be a lot of fun because he is a super smart guy and I love talking to him. So for now, news is next, and then midday news.